Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Mary Miller, and I'll be today's Hinckley Forum host. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through a generous bequest of the Nobel Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is Lobbying the Utah State Legislature. Today's guests are David Spadafor and Lincoln Schertz. Dave Spadafor is the president and CEO of Capstone Strategies, LLC, a wholly owned subsidiary of the David Spadafor Consulting Group, a Utah corporation. Capstone offers government relations and lobbying for its many and diverse clients, with an emphasis on municipal government, transportation, public safety, technology, communications, and public health. In the past, David has served as a budget analyst and legislative assistant for Salt Lake City Mayor Ted Wilson, and is a former two-time Hinckley intern. Lincoln Schertz directs the legislative effort for the Utah League of Cities and Towns. Schertz joined the Utah League of Cities and Towns staff in 2000 and just completed his 10th legislative session representing Utah's 244 cities and towns. Throughout the year, Mr. Schertz ensures that state and federal officials are aware of municipal positions on various policy issues. During the legislative sessions, Lincoln maintains daily contact with legislators regarding all bills monitored by the Association of Cities. Schertz specializes in state appropriation process, economic development, transportation-related issues, and state retirement issues. Lincoln Schertz received a degree in economics and a second degree in political science, both from the University of Utah. Please join me in welcoming our guests.
Good morning. Thank you, Mary. Now, in case you're wondering, I'm the Dave Spadafor, and I promise I'm sure Lincoln will be here, and Lincoln actually followed me at the Utah League of Cities and Towns, and I promise I will not treat this chair as Clint Eastwood did to the empty chair at the Republican National Convention. I have great respect for Lincoln, and as you know, getting here for an 8:05 class, it's awfully difficult. So what we'll do with Lincoln is we'll give him a couple of bad marks on his grades and citizenship, and obviously he may not get an A in the course, but we'll deal with that later. It's an honor to be here with you today. As Mary said, I'm a two-time Hinckley intern. My first internship was back in 1974. So that tells you how old I am. So I did two internships at Hinckley. And then it's always an honor and a pleasure for me to come back and hopefully share some experiences that I've had with you. As we approach the 2013 session, to tell you again how old I am, it will be my 39th legislative session. So I've done this quite a while. And as a matter of fact, my first legislative session, my first legislative session was 1975. And that's when I was a student at the University of Utah, just as you are, and I was involved in student government. And I was the Public Affairs Board Chairman. My guess is you still have within ASUU, the various entities and public affairs boards probably still there, and I represented ASUU at the university at the legislature, and the first bill I ever got passed was in 1975, and that was working with a good friend of mine, Mike Sibbett, who was a student at Utah State University, and we were successful in passing a bill putting a student on the Utah State Board of Regents. Everyone told us that we couldn't get it done. But, you know, when you're young, as you know, just as each of you are, you feel a little bit bulletproof. And you don't know what you don't know. And you just go ahead and try to do things. And we were successful. And the good part about that was it launched a long career. And I'm not sure it's very noteworthy, other than the fact that it'll be my 39th session coming up. Typically, and Lincoln and I have done this two or three times, and we kind of play off each other a little bit during the initial information. Let me start off and say a number of things, and then let's open it up to questions, and hopefully Lincoln will get here. But what I want this to be, whether he's here or not, is a dialogue amongst with all of us. Okay, so let's make sure that all of your questions that you have, we can attempt to answer them. Lobbying at the legislative session, to me, it's been my profession, as I said, for almost 40 years, and I think it's a noble profession, and we provide a good public service. And let me phrase it this way. When the legislature convenes on day one, there are 104 part-time legislators, 29 in the Senate, 75 in the House. Typically, there will be about 800 bills and resolutions that will be numbered. Of those 800 bills and resolutions that will be numbered, you'll probably have some discussion on half to a little bit more than half of them. Maybe as many as two-thirds. Lobbyists provide a service where we can provide the information for those pieces of legislation to the legislators who are part-time. We expect legislators to vote on every issue, and as a matter of fact, they're required to vote on every issue. And I'll segue a little bit saying I think we'll see one bill this year where a legislator is going to propose to allow a legislator to abstain in a vote if he or she has a conflict of interest. Utah is one of the fewest states in the country that do not allow abstentions. And this legislator is going to try to do that. But a legislator has to vote on every issue. And so what you want to do is you want that legislator to know as much as possible that they can absorb on issues, particularly those that are controversial, particularly those that are relatively complex, particularly those that are important to the public policy of the state. Without lobbyists providing information, that wouldn't happen. Now, what you hope for, what I hope for, what we hope for, is that legislator gets credible information. Now, one of the things that's very, very important is a lobbyist, our stock in trade, is the information that we provide, our credibility, our honesty, our integrity. If we were to pass on information that wasn't accurate, that would damage our credibility. And it's not like we're building a house or we're selling a car or we're installing a computer where you have a tangible result. What we have is intangible. And so the key there is we need to provide the information that legislators need to make decisions that are important to the people of the state of Utah. So our track record, our credibility, our history is what we provide to legislators when we present information. So it's absolutely critical that we as lobbyists provide accurate, credible information. And if you don't, then word travels pretty quickly, and then all of a sudden your credibility is damaged. Now, there are times when information that our clients give us that we prepare to present to others, may not be accurate, but we'll have to deal with that if and when that time comes, and sometimes it happens. So that's what we do. Taking a step back, there are three types of lobbyists. There's first the contract lobbyist, and that's what I am today. For the last 10 years as a contract lobbyist, I have about 14 or 15 clients who I deal with. I deal with primarily public safety. I represent the police chiefs and fire chiefs, the 911 call centers. I represent the public safety radio communication system for most of the state of Utah. So I have the public safety and the communications angle. I represent three cities. I represent a couple of private entities. But pretty much I focus on transportation, communication, public safety, a little bit of economic development. So that's where I've focused on now. I like to consider myself on the side of the angels. I represent the American Cancer Society, and so that's a public health client. But anyway, so those, and so there are three types of lobbyists. There's your contract lobbyist, there's your institutional lobbyist, and who that is an individual who works for an entity, whether it's Lincoln with Utah League of Cities and Towns. Lincoln has other clients, but Lincoln would be considered an institutional lobbyist. Whether it's your lobbyist for the University of Utah, and I can't think of his first name, but his last name is Perry. I'd have a brain cramp.
Jason.
Thank you. Jason Perry. It's terrible when you get old and you start to forget things. But Jason Perry does a great job for the University of Utah. He would be considered an institutional lobbyist. You have various folks who work for banks, work for credit unions, work for whomever, and they would be considered institutional lobbyists. Your third kind of lobbyist is your citizen lobbyist, your citizen activist. And these are the folks who go up to the Capitol, and they're there for a cause, for a reason, for an issue. And there are quite a few of those, and there are quite a few who are pretty effective. You know, probably one of the most effective citizen lobbyists, although some people may call her more of an institutional lobbyist, is Gail Ruzicka, you know, with the Eagle Forum. I'm not going to give Gail too much credibility, although we're very good friends, but Gail does a great job. And her lobbying actually starts during the political process, because people, legislators who are in solid Republican districts realize that their main constituency are the delegates who get elected, and the Eagle Forum elects delegates who make sure that those Republican legislators get nominated, and that's what gives her a lot of her influence and a lot of her power. But you have those three types of lobbyists. And generally speaking, we're all there to do the same thing, and that's provide information. We want to provide a public service, and we want to do a public service. Granted, you know, we're there earning money and making money, but still, our still goal is to do some good things. There are, as we look at all of that, lobbying has changed over the 39 years that I started, and I've been doing it. As a matter of fact, I was thinking as I was driving up here this morning, one of the issues, Tim, I don't think I've spoken about when I've been here before, is I started when there was a Democrat Speaker of the House and a Democrat President of the Senate. And we would think that's kind of odd this year when you have 5 Democratic senators out of 29 and I believe 14 House members out of 75. But that tells you, you know, that I've seen it all. My first legislative session back in 75, as I spoke about, there was a Democratic Speaker of the House, Ron Renger, and a Democrat President of the Senate, Ernie Dean. And things ebb and flowed for a few years, and now it's all been very Republican. This is actually, as I digress, and you'll find I digress often, when the 2013 session begins, it will be the fewest number of Democrats since the 1967 session. And now what makes it odd about 1967 is in 1964, Utah elected a Democratic governor for the first time in years, Calvin Rampton. They elected an overwhelming Democratic majority in the House and the Senate. And the Democrats controlled all of the state government officials. And that was way back when you guys weren't around, was when Lyndon Baines Johnson was elected for the first time in 1964 following the Kennedy assassination. And it was a Democratic landslide across the country. It was also one in Utah. Well, Democrats did so well in the 64 election, they thought, wouldn't it be great in 1965 to enact legislation that requires Utahns to register as a political party. So they required in 65 that all Utahns who are registered to vote to register either as a Democrat or a Republican. Well, the independent-minded Utahns got upset about that. In the 1966 election, they whitewashed all the Democrats, and the Republicans became entrenched at that point in time for a few years. But what happened was that the Utahns did not want to register as a party. Democrats, I think there were 14 Senate Democrat races in 1966. They lost 13 of the 14. It was just an amazing election. And the 1967 session opened with 5 Democrat senators and 13 Democrat House members, almost like it is today. But that's your little bit of history for your poli-sci class.
David, I might interject also nationally that year in 66, Republicans won 47 U.S. House seats. So it was not just Utah. It was also a national rejection that midterm election year of the Democratic Party, in large part because of Lyndon Johnson's entry into the Vietnam War.
So there's more history for you today. But that happened during the 66 election. So now we're starting now. When I first started back in the 70s, there was no such thing as a cell phone, of course. So there was no texting, there was no emails, there was no calling your clients. What they had was on the third floor between the House and the Senate, a bank of payphones, if you can believe that. And when we needed information, we had, you know, there was always a line at the payphones that we could call our clients to get what we needed, information that we needed. So, you know, 40 years ago, you know, your methods of communication were, it were face-to-face, which we still have today, were telephone calls, which we still have today, and were letters, which the U.S. Postal Service wishes we still had today. And so, but that was your method of communication 40 years ago. And there's no question that the best method of communication is face-to-face. That's, that way you can have that dialogue, that interchange. The telephone call is next. Now, over the 40 years, we've seen a huge change in the methods of communication. You know, we still have, you still have face-to-face, you still have your telephone calls, you still have your letters, ostensibly. But now we've added emails, we've added texts, we can add tweets, we can add Facebook. Although, you know, I'm not one for tweeting and Facebooking, although when I did help one of the local TV stations on their elections, they did give me a Twitter account. And I did tweet one night, and I think I had 11 followers, so I felt really good about that. But anyway, you know, so methods of communication have changed. And just to tell you that legislation really doesn't keep up with communication, a couple years ago, the legislature passed legislation, you know, that essentially kept confidential a lot of communications. And as we saw, the public, that backfired because government needs to be open. I think all of our people in the state of Utah and throughout the country believe government ought to be open. And unfortunately, that was a step back. However, let me just raise a couple of questions. I think, you know, from my perspective, emails to me are, it's an electronic mail. That's what it's called. Emails to me are like letters. And if your written letter is a public document, your email typically ought to be a public document. I will also go on the line to say when it comes to, for example, the texts, to me, texting is an offshoot of talking. And so I would say that texting, I have a question as to whether they really ought to be public documents, because it's a conversation that's going back that, granted, is not face-to-face, but technically it is on a telephone, just as if you were communicating. And that's where I think some of our legislators have gotten into trouble, is to the texting aspect. And it's interesting because I heard the other day, and I'm guilty. I've become guilty. I text my kids a lot. I text my grandkids a lot. Yeah, I text friends a lot. But someone said the other day that texting is making our interpersonal communications a lot less personal. And I really had to think about that for a second. How many of us text rather than dial a phone and talk to them? I think we all do. And a lot of that is because now we can multitask if we text, because we can talk to three or four people at the same time by texting. We can text and do something else, but when you're on the phone, you really have to talk to somebody. But it's really making our personal communications a lot more impersonal. So you've got the different kinds of lobbyists, you've got the different kinds of communication, and we have, you know, hundreds of pieces of legislation. Your good lobbyist is going to do a couple of things. Now, of course, we're paid to present our clients' information. What we hope for is the issues that aren't that complex or aren't that controversial. Because if that's the case, you work things out, you move forward. Legislators love to see things worked out. And if they can sit everybody down in a room and try to figure things out, figure the issues out, resolve what's the best in public policy, they're going to like to do that. They very seldom like to take things that are very controversial. But if lobbyists have a bill that's complex or controversial, what I like to do with my legislators is not only tell them what my side of the issue is, but also tell them what some of the problem areas are and what some of my opponents may tell them. Because if I do that, then what I can say is this is a great piece of legislation. It does A, B, C, D. Now, you're going to hear from my colleague so-and-so, and he's going to tell you that it's not that good of a deal because of A, B, and C. But on the at the bottom line, this is why, when all the issues are worked out, this is why it's a better approach. And if you can, if you know what your opponents are going to say, then you're better prepared to argue for your client and for your side. And so those are some of the things that I think are important. Let me break now and see if there are any questions or comments, and I can continue to fill in if there's a downside. But what I want to do is particularly because it's just me, I'll take a drink of my coffee, but respond to your questions and your comments, and then I can also tell you more stories.
So we will now devote the remainder of time for questions from the audience. If you have a question, please state your name and something about yourself and speak clearly into the microphone.
Hi, I'm Rochelle Roberts, and I'm a senior here at the University of Utah. And I'm just wondering why you picked the area of lobbying that you picked. What made you choose that area specifically as opposed to some of the other types that you outlined?
Good morning. Thank you for being with us. As I indicated, you know, the areas that I have right now, I've kind of migrated to. And what happened was in 1975, I lobbied the legislature on behalf of the University of Utah students, passed a bill. That was exciting to me. That summer, a friend of mine was involved, I think, as a Hinckley intern for a city commission candidate. His name was Jesse Graz. And he said, come and help on the campaign. And I worked on a campaign in 74. I liked it. So in 1975, it was a city race, and I got involved to help Jesse Graz be elected. He was elected. And the best thing that ever happened is politics in its finest. You help a candidate, he wins, and guess what? He gives you a job. And I thought, this is pretty neat, you know. And so I started working that as soon as he got elected for Salt Lake City. And it was a part-time job pretty much until I graduated from the U in 1976. And during the 76 session, I lobbied both a little bit for ASUU and also for Salt Lake City. And then in after I graduated from the U in 76, his administrative assistant resigned. And Commissioner Graz appointed me to his administrative assistant. And so here was this 21-year-old kid, you know, had a pretty good job working for Salt Lake City. I thought, hey, this is pretty cool. And so I immediately started to work and do a lot of municipal stuff. And we were in charge of public works, so I knew a lot of transportation stuff, a lot of communication stuff. And over the next three years, I was doing Salt Lake City's lobbying stuff. And it was back then, lobbying was a lot different than it is today because you didn't have a lot of full-time people. You actually had no full-time lobbyists. It was just, they were all institutional or citizen lobbyists. And so I did that. 1979, Salt Lake City changed the form of government from the old commission form, which was a mayor and four commissioners over departments, to what we now have, which is the mayor-council form. And so I lost my job because there was no administrative assistant to the Public Works Department. And Mayor Wilson had me do lobbying for the city and then had me do budget work for him. And that lasted for 2 years. And I did two city budgets and realized I hated it. So then I just focused on the legislative side and started my own business. So those things allowed me to focus on municipal government and on public safety and transportation.
I'm Joel Johnson, political science major here at the university. I'm just wondering, at what point do you have to register as a lobbyist, and what does that process look like?
Joel, good morning. Nice to see you again. Seen Joel around a number of years. I just passed my ethics test when I re-registered as a lobbyist, Joel, and you're going to ask me a question I may flunk on. You have to register as a lobbyist once you start lobbying for an entity, whether it's if a contract lobbyist, as soon as you have your first contract, you lobby. If you're working for a company and you know you're going to be at the legislature, you need to register as a lobbyist. If you're working for a government, you may not have to register. You do if you want to make sure that everything is above board. But so as soon as you know you're going to be there and represent somebody, you have to register. If you're a citizen lobbyist and you're not getting paid, and you're there just on your own, you don't have to register. Now, when you register, you have some requirements. For example, it used to be $25 every session, every 2 years. Now it's $100 every 2 years. You know, which is not much, considering what lobbyists can make. So you register every 2 years, and you have to update your client list every 2 years. The state statute requires that when you add new clients, you're supposed to add that to your lobby list. And so that happens. Every year now, we're required to take an ethics test. And we can do that online. And it's not it's not quite an open book test, but it's close to being an open book test because you can have your statutes there, and we have to pass the ethics test, Joel, and get 25 out of 25 questions correctly. Now I'm going to say I missed a couple the first time, had to go back and take it again, you know, and it's an interesting thing because there are some questions that what they do is they kind of meander between the reporting laws. And the for reporting laws as a lobbyist and reporting statutes as a contributor to a political part to a candidate or a party, and that's what kind of confused me. But if you register as a lobbyist, whether you spend money to entertain or not, you have to file a quarterly report about how much you've spent and what for.
My name's Scott Mellis. I'm currently a senior here studying political science. My question for you is, what advice would you give to students who may be considering a career in lobbying?
Scott, good question. What I would say, my first suggestion would be that what you want to do is to try to – the key to a lobbyist – I'll back up a little bit. The key to a lobbyist is you become familiar with the legislators, they trust you, you know what you're talking about, and you can communicate. So saying that – you know, my primary suggestion to you would be that you determine what area or areas you want to focus on and then do a couple of things. Either become an intern with a legislator or try to hook up with a company or an association or an organization, an area that you'd like to focus on. And then using that as a springboard, then make yourself visible at the legislature. Make sure people know who you are, who you represent, and the fact that you know what you're talking about. And if you do that, that's a step in the right direction. Another angle is get involved in legislative campaigns and start to know legislators that way. And legislators can suggest others that you would be a good fit as an intern or as an associate in an organization.
My name is Carter Folger, and I'm a student of political science here at the U, I guess. My question, kind of a personal one, but do you have a favorite legislature or a favorite piece of legislation that you've worked on over the years? You've been on the Hill for a long time, so I'm sure you've seen some interesting things go through.
That's a great question. I'm going to answer that this way, and this might be a way that's going to get me into a little bit of trouble too, Carter. The first thing is, do I have a favorite legislature? Not really, except I would probably in a heartbeat go back into the 80s and 90s. And the reason I would is because I think the folks that we had who were serving back then were more interested in doing good public policy than partisan politics. We would have knockdown, drag-out fights. But at the end of the day, everybody left as friends. And at the end of the day, the bottom line was, what's best for the state of Utah? Today, it's disappointing to me that I think our legislature, and I think other state legislatures have become the same way, have become a microcosm of our United States Congress. And that is very partisan, very political. And using that at times, it becomes very difficult to say that at the end of the day, the right things have happened. Now, when you say, well, when you have 24 Republicans and 5 Democrats in the Senate, how partisan can it really be? Well, it can't, you know, because it's so one-sided, you know. But what's happened is because of the conservative radio talk show hosts, because of the polarization of partisanship, I think even our legislature has become even more partisan that way. And I think it makes a difference. Even though I make considerably more today than I did 20 years ago, I think the public policy back then was substantially better. Second part of your question. You know, I've been involved in a lot of issues, you know, over 40 years. You know, and I think a handful of them, and if I can go through a handful and explain why, would be my favorite. One that comes to mind is the first one that got me started with putting a suit on the State Board of Regents. You know, that to me was an interesting piece of legislation because I'd never done it before. And it was a challenge. And, you know, back in the mid-70s, I was very active in the Democratic Party, had a Democratic governor. The folks who worked for Governor Rampton were friends of mine. You know, one of his primary assistants, a gentleman named Kent Briggs, told me that there was no way in the world we'd get the bill passed. You know, I actually dated a secretary in the governor's office. You know, and so it was a personal thing. And so that one comes back as the very first success, as a big one. After that, I think there are three or four that I think that raise a lot of interest. And in 1983. Working for the Utah League of Cities, working for Salt Lake City at the time, up until 1983, up in 1983, the local option sales tax, and you're going to say, what's that? If you look at your sales tax bill when you go to a grocery store or you go to buy something, you'll pay 7% sales tax, roughly. Almost 5% of that is state. And then there's part of it that's local option and part of it that goes to UTA. Up until 1983, that local option sales tax was 0.75%. And it was all distributed back to the point of sale of where that purchase took place. Well, going up through, and that was since the Depression days in the 30s. As Utah was growing, what was happening was your core city areas, like Salt Lake, Ogden, Provo, who used to be the major population centers, were no longer the population centers. You had suburbs like Sandy, West Jordan grow. Your rural areas were growing. And so these folks, the mayors who represented the suburban areas, said, wait a minute, our people are going into your commercial centers to shop. And it's not fair that you get all the local option sales tax money and we don't get any. So in 1982... this is a long story, but it has a couple of humorous turns. In 1982, they introduced legislation that would have made that 0.75% local option sales tax distributed half point of sale, half population. And it passed. Governor Matheson at that year, it was the governor, he vetoed the bill. And he vetoed the bill because, you know, a lot of us from the cities asked him to, and he did. But also, there was a constitutional issue. Up until that point in time, there are two types of revenue sharing. Vertical revenue sharing, which is the state can pass a tax and it would go down to local governments, or horizontal revenue sharing, where it was a tax was passed at the local level, and horizontal revenue sharing is City A gives some to City B. Both horizontal and vertical revenue sharing was unconstitutional through 1982. 82 session, January, February. So Governor Matheson vetoed the bill. Well, a couple of things happened. You had your reapportionment. Every happens every 10 years. Well, more legislative seats were now being divvied out to your suburban areas. So we lost in 82. We figured that we could lose again in 83. The other thing that happened in 1982 was the Constitutional Revision Commission. Utah has what's called a Constitutional Revision Commission, and these are constitutional scholars, other folks, who take a look at Utah's Constitution and want to keep it updated. Well, on the ballot in 1982, November, was a provision that would allow make constitutional horizontal revenue sharing. So in November of 1982, it passed. So, and we kind of thought it was going to pass. So what we had to do back in 1982 was figure out how to resolve this issue. How do we resolve, because as cities, and I was at Salt Lake City at the time, how do we resolve not losing again at the legislature? So we came up with this wonderful compromise of taking the 0.75-cent local option sales tax, increasing it to 1%, and then over a period of 5 years, phasing in a 50-50 point-of-sale population distribution. We thought that was the way to go. But legislators hate raising taxes. So in 1983, we began, in the legislative session, we began this approach. And in 1982, you had a civil war among cities and towns. You know, we had one organization. If Lincoln were here, you know, he would tell you that there are 244 cities and towns. Well, not all cities are created equal. You have cities like Salt Lake City, Ogden, Provo, your big core cities. You had, back then, your Sandy, West Jordan, South Jordan, cities that were not core, but they had a lot of population, but not a lot of retail. You had cities that spent a lot of money, cities that didn't spend a lot of money. So the Civil War in 1982 was so bad that the organization, Utah League of Cities and Towns, my mayor, Ted Wilson, was on the board. Well, he got so ticked that the director of the Utah League of Cities and Towns was a friend of mine, Herschel Hester. He grabbed the letterhead and he crossed out the word cities on the letterhead. And he said, "Congratulations, you're now the director of the Utah League of Towns." That's how bad it became. So what we needed to do is we needed to try to bring everybody back together again. And that's why we came up with this compromise. And what we had to do is we had to get statesmen who were willing from the core cities to say, yes, we can share. We had to get statesmen from the cities who were the suburbs to say, yes, let's go, let's make sure nobody gets hurt. So 1983, we introduced legislation. And going back then, the state economy wasn't that great. And there were some needs that the state had. So we put together an organization statewide that we came in with about 30 sponsors in the House to raise the sales tax by a quarter cent and distribute and redistribute it. But it was a battle because you had your folks who hated to raise taxes. You had state folks who did not want to raise the sales tax because the state also had a sales tax and they didn't want local governments to have a greater share of the sales tax. So it was a big battle. We get to the floor of the legislature, and you need 38 votes. Let me digress again. 75 House members, you need 38 to pass. You need a constitutional majority to pass. Senate, you have 29. You need 15, a constitutional majority to pass in the Senate. So anyway, you need 38. Well, and if it's a controversial issue like that was, you never want to go to the floor with 38 votes because you're going to lose people. So we had about 43 or 40 votes. And I remember it vividly, 43 or 44. And we had these counting sheets, and we had all their names, and we checked them all off, and we knew where everybody was going to vote. Well, the major, and back then, this is why I like to go back 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Right now, if you're a lobbyist, because of security issues and because of professionalism, you can't be on the House or Senate floor. And I agree with that. But 20 and 30 years ago, I lived in the back rooms. Literally, because I represented local government. I was in their kitchen all the time. I was on the House and Senate floor all the time. And not all of the other lobbyists had that privilege. But, you know, and we didn't take that privilege lightly. You know, we didn't, for example, we never talked to legislators about issues unless they asked us. But we were on the House floor all the time. So here's this House bill, and it's on the House floor. Norm Bangeter, this is before he became governor, he's Speaker of the House. Well, we're standing on the back row of the House floor, and I've got my vote count. Debate's going just exactly how I thought, and I thought, this is going to be great. We're going to win. Well, the major opponent of the bill was a legislator by the name of Franklin Knowlton. And Frank Knowlton, for those who are of my generation, would know that he is the father of truth in taxation legislation, and he hated raising taxes. And my sponsor was Lamont Richards, who represented the University of Utah area. Right now it's Joel Briscoe, but back then it was Lamont Richards. And what's interesting is Lamont and Frank Knowlton were first cousins. And to watch them go to battle over this bill was the funnest thing to watch, because they really had their family fights on this piece of legislation. Well, Frank Knowlton comes up to me and says, "You don't have the votes." And I said, "Respectfully speaking, I do." And he goes, "Let me see your count." And I wasn't naive enough, and I knew what he was going to do, so I showed him my count, and I saw what he did. He looked down the list, and he eyed about five or six people who he thought were going to vote against the bill. And what he did is he walked. Legislators can walk all over the floor in the House. So he was walking to talk to all those five or six people who he eyed off my list. And he came back to me and he said, "Spadafore, congratulations, you've got your votes." I said, "Well, thank you." And he goes, "But you're still not going to pass." And I thought to myself, what does that mean? Well, I quickly learned what that meant. Now remember, 75 members of the legislature, you need a constitutional majority to pass, 38 votes. You need two-thirds to stop debate, 50. Okay? Now, you need two-thirds of those present to stop debate, which is 50. He knew I didn't have 50. So this debate was going on and on and on because I couldn't stop debate. I didn't have 50 votes to cut off debate. And it was an all-afternoon affair. And that's why this is why it's so memorable, because for two reasons. It changed public policy, but it was memorable. But anyway, so we'd get 43, we'd get 45, we'd get 47, we'd get 48, and couldn't get to 50. Well, anyway, we're getting close now. Now, and we've been debating now for 3 hours, and people are just saying the same things over and over and over again. But they couldn't cut off debate. Well, anyway, there was a little-known first-year legislator in 1983 by the name of Olene Walker, okay, who grew up and became governor and did a great job. And Olene is a tremendous stateswoman in our state. She was up. Now, I'm standing in the back behind my sponsor where lobbyists can stand. Now, remember, there's no lobbying on the House floor. So, and that's back when you didn't have an – right now you have an electronic board. You know, 30 years ago, your board wasn't electronic. It was chalkboard and chalk. And when they put bills on, they had to write it in chalk. When they took them off, they erased them. Well, anyway, the next two bills on the board were sponsored by Olene Walker. And she did not support our bill because she didn't want to raise taxes. So we're at 49. Olene was one of the red lights on 49. It was 49-26. So I got up from my spot in the back, and she was in the second row. So, I mean, she's to the front of the House chambers. Got it from the back, walked to Olene. So now here I am, a lobbyist, on the second row. I mean, you know, if the speaker is right here, I was right, you know, 15 feet from the speaker. And I said, "Representative Walker," I said, "I know you hate the bill. I know you're going to vote no. Fine, vote no. You've got the next two bills on the board. Don't you really think you ought to, you know, cut off debate and then you can have your bills?" And so she flipped from red to green, which gave me 50 votes. At that point in time, Speaker Bangeter looks down and says, "Do I need to remind some people that there is no lobbying on the House floor?" And I'm looking up, and what do? You're guilty. You know, it's not like he can say, "I'm not lobbying," because he knew what I did. She changed her vote, for heaven's sakes. Well, anyway, debate stopped. We passed the bill. And I'm thinking, this is going to be great. We're going to pass this thing. And we had about 8 or 9 days to go before the session ended. And it passed the House. Now it has to go over to the Senate, right? Doesn't show up. Doesn't show up. Next day, not there. 2 days away, not there. 3 days away, not there. 4 days away, not there. And I know something's going on. I just don't know what. What had happened was, Speaker Bangeter hated the bill, just hated it, didn't want to raise taxes. Secondly, though, the Board of Regents had about $50 million of buildings they wanted built on college campuses. There was no money to pay for the bond. So what Norm Bangeter did, and what he called over to the Senate President Cap Ferry and said, "I'm sending you a bill." Told him the number. I think it was House Bill 27. Said, "Don't read it in." See, there is no requirement that you have to read a bill in. And now it's changed. But anyway, back then, what happened was, is the bill got over to the Senate. The president gave it to the chief clerk of the Senate and told her to keep it in her drawer, which she did. Until Norm, Speaker Bangeter, got all the legislators who represented college campuses together and said, you want the spectrum at Cedar City? I need you to vote to take some of that money away from the cities. And so what had happened about 4 days later is all of these legislators who represented college campuses came and said, we've got a compromise. What the speaker wants is he wants half of your money for 4 years to pay for the bond to build the buildings on all the college campuses. And so we had to regroup. And what do you do? You know, all of the guys who were our supporters said, come on, I need the spectrum at Cedar City. At CEU, it was the Bunnell Dimitrich Center. And it was named after Bunnell Dimitrich because Bunnell was the senator and Dimitrich was the House member. And they were supporting us, but they're saying, guys, we need to build this building. But there was a building on every college campus. So eventually what happened was we got the bill passed. It took us 4 extra years to get the money. Part of the money then in 85 went to pay for the pumps, but that was a most notable thing. Other than that, I've raised cigarette taxes, I've changed Indoor Clean Air Act laws for the American Cancer Society, you know, so you can go to a bar and not reek of smoke if you don't smoke. You know, I've changed formulas for distribution of highway funds. Done a lot of things. I helped pass legislation to create the money to build the venues for the Olympics. That was also fun. Only me and my grandson will know that. No one else knows and cares anymore. Sorry for the long answer, but I thought it was an interesting story.
Okay. My name is Dallin Johnson. I'm a senior of economics at the U of U, and I minor in political science. I was doing a little bit of research on some of the committees for this upcoming legislative session. And being an economics student, I looked at the Business Economic Development and Labor Appropriations Subcommittee. And of those 18 members, none of them really have a substantial background in economics. Most of them are, just like in everything else, they're lawyers. And I know lobbyists are there to kind of educate and further what they know about that subject. But do you see a problem with that? They have a chief economist and a fiscal analyst, but besides that, there's no economic education in that.
Good question. Now, two or three points. First of all, every appropriations committee will have your analyst and your chief economist, and they're there to provide staff support. It would be great if there were more folks who had an economic background to sit on a committee like that, or to sit on any of the appropriations committees. It's just not going to happen, you know. And that's why it's important that they have good staff people, which they do. And that's why it's important that there are folks who can help educate from the lobbyist side of it how to deal with those sorts of issues. Now, remember, an appropriations committee, let me just take a step back. Governor Herbert presented his budget. It's interesting because most legislative leaders have said that budget isn't going to happen during the legislative session, so we'll see what happens on the budget. But what happens now is each state department responds to an appropriations subcommittee. So you've got in that particular subcommittee, you're going to probably have your Department of Commerce. You're probably going to have your Department of Labor. There might be Workforce Services might be there. No, the Workforce Services would be someplace else. Maybe the Insurance Commission might be there. Those parts will do the lobbying. That's also a committee that will deal with single appropriations for projects. And so what you hope for is the information that is presented to them by the departments and presented to them by individuals such as me and my colleagues will help them make a good answer. But if you had legislators who had an economics background, a business background, when it comes to the Appropriations Subcommittee, we'd be farther along. Let me just tell you a little story that happened on that committee. I'm not going to tell you who raised that committee. I have a client, American Cancer Society, and over the last American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. The Cancer Action Network is a 501c4, which allows us to lobby. American Cancer Society is a 501c3, which you can't. So you need to make sure, I say, especially for those on listening on tape, Cancer Action Network. We're going to ask the legislature this year for $1.6 million to help us build what's called a Hope Lodge. And there are 31 Hope Lodges around the country. And what it is it's like a Ronald McDonald House for adults. Folks come to Salt Lake if they have cancer, either to Huntsman, IHC, or whatever. And sometimes they have a three-week, you know, intensive cancer treatment window. And if you live around your provider, then you drive and go home. That's fine. But if you don't, you either have to stay with friends, stay in a hotel, or you don't get treatment. What a Hope Lodge is it provides hope for the family and the caregiver, where the individual getting therapy and the caregiver will have a place to stay for 21 days, rent-free, everything is provided for them. And brick-and-mortar cost is about $16 million, and we've raised about 12 already. And as a matter of fact, the LDS Church has donated an old chapel that they don't use that will be, that it's on, I may, hopefully, it's 4th East and 1st South. I think that's the address. Where we're partnering with Habitat for Humanity, where they're going to come in and they're going to take down the building. They're going to preserve everything they can inside the building to be used for other housing projects. And then they're going to work with us to build the building. And it's going to be really cool. It's a $16 million project. And so we're going to ask the legislature for 10% of the brick-and-mortar funds, $1.6 million. So a week ago, I'm chuckling, a week ago I sent out an email to all of these members of the committee. And I sent out a one-page fact sheet, a connection to our web, so they could look at an eight-minute video that really tells you the story of what Hope Lodge is. One of the legislators on that committee writes back and says, you know, I wish you well. I support your project, but you know, I don't sit on social services appropriations anymore. You know, you'll have to go there. He didn't even know that his responsibility on this committee is to take a look at projects such as that. So I sent him back an email saying, "Thank you so much for saying you're going to support the contribution. And oh, by the way, projects like this are funded on your new appropriations committee. So I look for your support." Haven't heard back from him or her. I'm not going to say who.
Thank you very much for your excellent presentations. My name is Alid. I'm a junior here at the University of Utah. I have two questions for you. The first one is, you said earlier that the biggest job of being a lobbyist is to provide information. So my question is, how do you find this kind of information, and how do you know that a legislator need a particular information? And my second question is, what do you think the biggest or the hardest part of being a lobbyist in the United States? Thank you.
Very, very good questions. In terms of the information that we provide to legislators, you know, hopefully, the organizations that I represent have people who work there full time. Well, that's not true. The police chiefs and the fire chiefs don't have people. You know, they're full time police chiefs, full time fire chiefs. Excuse me. But what we try to do is, I'll do some of the research myself. But hopefully the clients who I work with will provide me the information, because that's what they do full time. And I think that's how the issues are pretty much with all of the lobbyists, is the folks they work with, you know, will give them the background information. But what we have to do with that information is, I'm going to call it, provide a filter or a funnel. If you look at a funnel, And what you do with the funnel is you pour a lot of information in, and some it comes through in an organized fashion at the bottom of the funnel. When it comes to information, that's kind of like what we do, is all of our clients bring us all this information. What we have to do is we have to determine, I think, what we believe are the cogent issues that the legislators will accept. You know, what they need to know, the importance of that, and then how to present it to them in a method that they can accept it and process it. So that's the process. we have our clients provide who work with us, and based on what we do, what our clients provide us, we shape it, we form it, we put it into a one-page sheet, we highlight the information, then give it to the legislators. That's pretty much how it happens. Your second question was
the hardest part of being a lobbyist.
For me, I think it's the emotional aspect. And let me explain that a little bit more. We all love to win. We all hate to lose. Right? You know, nobody gets up in the morning and says, God, I hope I lose today. That just doesn't happen. You know, and so when you talk about the hardest part is on complex or controversial issues, you know you've got somebody who's going to be on the opposite side. And that's okay. To me, the hardest part is understanding the emotional aspects of being a lobbyist. As I said earlier, I think on the question about the legislature's become so polarized, at times so do lobbyists. And as I've grown and matured, and some people will say I haven't matured yet, but as I've grown and tried to mature, you know, it's important to me that people feel good about what they do and respect what others do. When you're younger, sometimes you don't respect what others do nearly as much as when you're older. And that's a part of the maturation process. And I see a lot of the lobbyists who are younger than I am who I think they want to win at any cost. And that's okay. Winning at any cost is fine. But if you win at any cost, there are going to be situations where there are going to be consequences. Now, one of the things that I do, I've done quite a bit in the last 3 or 4 years, is think back to say, when I was in my 30s, was I like that? You know, and regretfully, I kind of say, yeah, I probably was. And so the emotional aspect of not just winning and losing, but winning gracefully, and also trying to realize that good public policy just isn't winning or losing. It's doing what's best and making sure everybody feels good. To me, that's the hardest part of lobbying, is where is that line? And I'll tell you, you know, there are some of my colleagues who would just prefer to walk all over you. You know, and on the football field, that's okay. You know, I was in the stands. You know, one of the things I do for fun is during the football games, I do the stats for the radio broadcast, for the ESPN radio broadcast. I'm up in the booth, and you know, when you guys are in the muss and you're freezing your butt off on a night game against Arizona in November, you know, I'm up and nice and warm, okay? But I remember a few years ago when we were playing Wyoming and Kyle Whittingham kicked an onside kick when Utah was beating Wyoming 50-0. And the Wyoming coach flipped him off. That's not winning gracefully. But I understand why Kyle did it, because the Wyoming coach was a real jerk. But you get to a point where, you know, nobody hates, nobody likes to lose, and nobody likes a bad winner. You know, and so what we need to do with lobbyists is become a little more centric in that.
This concludes today's Hinckley Forum. Please join me in thanking our guest.